Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of the For the Reef podcast, where we dive into the reef keeping hobby and the coral reef conservation. We had some super fun technical difficulties and lost the podcast that we were just recording, but we're back in action now, and hopefully the audio is coming through clear. My name is Mitch Dender, with co-host Ian Bell.
Hello.
And we're super lucky to be talking with Aaron Hunt today of the Cayman Eco Divers. Welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Hi there. How are you both doing?
Aaron's been super patient in sticking with our technical difficulties here and was happily agreed to repeat himself.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is I'm really talkative, so it won't be a problem.
Yeah.
Just remember,
I guess to start, let's just jump right into it. Aaron, would you like to kind of describe what the Cayman Eco Divers is and when you started it?
Yes. Well, our program is the same thing that we do every night. We try to take over the world. Essentially, we have created a program here in the Cayman Islands where we are working with local dive operations and residents that live here on island to essentially create a continual string of coral nurseries that will act as spawning stations. And each one of those spawning stations is responsible for saturating a localized part of the reef with coral spawn every summer. And we have found that in our initial tests, we went from 3 to 7 corals of the specific species we were working with, which is the Acropora cervicornix or staghorn coral, to 42, 43 corals in the first year when we went back and saw what the effects of spawning and then recruitment and survival till the following year was. The second year when we went back, we were in excess of 200, closer to 250. It becomes a little bit difficult at that point to count because many of the pieces overlap one another, and it's like counting leaves in a tree. I mean, you can get a final number, but there's going to be some conflicting reports when you have 2 or 3 people doing the same count. Our efforts now are to go out in the course of the next couple of weeks and see what year 3 has resulted in with our coral spawning. But
well, just to give everybody kind of an idea of what you mean, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people listening that might not have ever really read into much of about coral restoration and how these things work. So could you just describe what a coral nursery is and kind of how you build them and what they look like?
Yes. I forget sometimes shop talk and I get going. I'm so used to having volunteers that live here on island that have worked with me over the course of several years that I sometimes forget to start at the beginning. Essentially, our program is set up like a lot of the existing coral reef management, coral reef restoration, or reef renewal programs elsewhere in the world. We, like many other programs, have 2 primary activities. We have nurseries that provide a safe place for us to take wild corals to and then allow them to live in a stress-free environment. And then we have transplantation away from that nursery somewhere else out on the reef. But over the course of the last couple of years, we have veered off from the standard methodology used. And by virtue of experimentation and very careful planning, we have come up with a process where our corals are not impacted by storms. They are not impacted by bleaching events. They are not targeted by predators. And that has meant that our nurseries are extremely survivable. It is the safe place that we intend for the nursery to be for those corals that we have taken off the reef and have put into our care. And as a result of the stunning survival that we have with our corals in the nursery, we have reevaluated what transplanting corals out to the reef looks like. Most programs, after a period of 6 months to 2 years, will take the corals from those nurseries and relocate them somewhere out on the reef. And you oftentimes hear all these impressive projects of 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 corals having been moved. And when you close your eyes, I'm sure that that feels like a huge area of the reef that has been seeded with life and can now survive on its own. What we found is when we were operating in that manner for the first year or so, 2 years of our program, 1,000 pieces of coral isn't quite what was being explained versus what was really being handled. Most people would take a 2-year-old piece of coral that had grown 2 foot in branches with little offshoots that are, you know, 4 or 5 inches long, and would break them into little 3-inch to 5-inch sections. And they would take 100 or 200 pieces and fragment them right there the very day of transplant and make roughly 1,000 pieces out of that. And then they would relocate those somewhere out onto the reef. Freshly fragmented corals. I know a lot of the people that would be listening to this podcast can understand the stress that that puts on the corals and the obvious physical injury that the corals experience. If you're going to move the corals from that safe environment in the nursery, is it a practical or a prudent thing with these corals that we've spent so much time raising for the last 6 months to 2 years to move them out where we know that there are potential diseases, predators, viruses that can affect them and in fact have historically been responsible for a massive wipeout of the corals? And in fact, what we find is the survival rate for corals that are directly transplanted onto the reef like that is abysmal. I'm not going through all the effort to raise these corals just to watch them die within days of me transplanting them. So instead, we just make new nurseries somewhere else on the reef. And we've created a list of guidelines that allow us to have a high rate of success for these nurseries. And they're rather unusual requirements. We have to be in fairly deep water, like 60 foot deep water. We have to be away from the reef. We want to be out in the middle of a sandy area. And there's thought behind each one of these steps. What we found is some of the biggest threats to coral in order of events is disease. Where do most coral diseases live at? On the reef. Can they be transferred? Certainly. How far? I'm not really sure. But if we move our corals even 50 foot off the reef out into the middle of a sandy area, and then in 60 foot of water, run a 20 foot rope up to 40 foot somewhere midwater, we have yet, after 4 or 5 years of our corals being in the nurseries, to find any instances of disease or viruses reaching our corals. So likewise.
I wanted to just talk a little bit about how you're selecting these nursery sites, because I think, I mean, I'm probably going to ask a lot of, you know, stupid questions, but
no dumb questions, but not till you're level three.
let me just ask some dumb questions here, because I just want to make sure it's nice and clear for me. So I guess the difference that you're finding and what you're kind of crediting your success to is selecting sites, you know, where your nurseries are going. And these sites are, you know, historically, when you compare them to core restoration techniques in the past, are a little different, right? They're a little deeper.
Very different, to the point where when we've interacted with other programs, they are just a side of angry that we would choose to put the corals in these obviously different locations. And there's been arguments and questioning about why we would do this and, oh, this won't work. And I would point out that 4 or 5 years down the road, it clearly works.
Do you find that it limits the species? I know that you talked about, the staghorn coral. Are there any species? I mean, at those depths, is there any other requirements that are limiting the number of species or the different types of corals that you can grow, or are you just focusing on certain types? Or
currently, we have not yet found any signs that the corals are suffering being in deeper water. And it may be a virtue of the high water quality we have here in the Cayman Islands. We don't have a lot of agricultural runoff. We don't have a lot of sedimentation. A lot of days here in the Cayman Islands, especially on a calm day in the summer, you can get probably 200 foot of visibility underwater. It is stunning. And because of that, light penetrates quite deep. To be out in 150 to 200 foot, everything's blue, but it's still really bright outside if the sun's out. We don't need to go that deep, but to be out at 30 or 40 foot deep where the nurseries rest suspended midwater, the only difference in the light that is reaching them versus being in shallower water is that the water blocks the larger wavelengths of light, the red wavelengths of light. And in fact, that is a benefit for us because red wavelengths of light carry a greater heat signature with them than the smaller wavelengths of the blue and the green that is so visible when you're scuba diving. And once we get down below about 20 foot, pretty much all the red, yellow, orange light, it stops being available. And at that point, the corals may go through a shift of what zooxanthellae algae live inside of them, providing the pigmentation. They may go through a stress period if they're used to being in 5-10 foot of water. But unlike a light shocked coral that goes from 60 foot up to 5 foot, bringing them down into deeper water is still very manageable for the corals. And we haven't really had any issues with mortality or anything. And I know that there is definitely a point of view out there that's like, oh, they need to be in shallow water. They need that added light energy. But that light carries heat with it. And if you're in water that is within 1 degree Fahrenheit of bleaching, even a half degree Fahrenheit difference on the inside of that coral can be a big difference and a reason for that coral to either bleach or not to bleach. And by moving them into that deeper water, I honestly believe that that is a critical part of why our corals don't respond by bleaching when we find bleaching events happening all across the Caribbean.
So just for people that don't know what a nursery looks like, you may have seen pictures online or whatever. These are a series of frameworks made of fiberglass poles suspended on air floats and anchored to the ocean floor 60 or so feet off the reef. Mm-hmm. Aaron will explain this better than I can, but just his methodology has turned to, there are a series of these things now, groups of these trees, I call them, anchored at specific distances from each other now along the entire west side of the island. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then can you explain why the west side and south side there are ideal locations and just sort of the logistics of how the currents work and how that's working to your favor?
Well, in setting up our program, we had about a 2-year period where we were unable to move corals out to the reef. And so we sat down and pulled up existing scientific documentation about pretty much every aspect of what we could do to help make our corals more survivable. And even at that early stage where we thought, we'll just move them back out on the reef because that's what everybody does, we still had the overall goal that getting the corals out onto the reef was not the end step. And in fact, the next step past that was for the corals to spawn after they've been transplanted out onto the reef. And because of that, we were expecting that we would move smaller numbers of coral in a more careful and controlled manner, because it's the gametes, the juveniles that come from those transplanted corals that would be providing the real long-term addition to the reef that we would be monitoring and managing. What we found, though, is over the course of a couple of years, our nurseries were spawning, and we were getting video and photo of that. And in the documentation, we found up to 2 kilometers could be considered the area of impact of any coral when it goes to spawn for the Acroporus cervicornis staghorn species. They tend to be a locally resupplying species. And what we really noticed is within 500 meters, so about a quarter of that distance, there was an area of heavy saturation, a cone of impact, if you will, that started at the nursery and then spread out at a nice even 45 degrees out towards the reef. And within about 100 to 200 yards, it went from there wasn't any staghorn to, oh my God, there's one and there's one and there's one. And it almost became comical in the second year. And even at this point where there's hundreds of them now. And so we decided that instead of directly returning corals to the reef, because the mortality is so catastrophically high on just about every project that's out there, and even with all of our planning and all of our effort, we were still holding around 85% survival as opposed to 100%, that we wanted to get that 100% survival that a nursery environment would offer. And while we have nurseries at several shoreside locations, we understood that there were suitable places all around the island that would work as nursery sites that might be accessible by boat or that might be a little bit more difficult to get to, but we could set up mini nurseries at a number of places around the island. And so what we've done is we measured off 1,000 meters. Twice as far as what we've observed the cone of intense saturation of coral spawning, but only half as far as what the reports that we've read state the corals can be transferred. And every 1,000 foot or 1,000 meters or so, we put another little mini nursery, a couple of coral nursery structures, maybe 7 or 8 genetics at each one of them. And we let those spawn. And what we're hoping to find is that because the currents here in the Cayman Islands move both northward and then southward in the course of one single day, the chance of the coral spawning and being carried north is about the same as the chance of them being caught by the southern current. And we've observed both directions from our primary nursery at Sunset House. But
Aaron, how have you seen the reefs decline? You know, how long have you been living there? And have you kind of witnessed the decline? Where has the need come from, basically, is what I'm asking.
Well, I've been here a little over 10 years, and I was well into being a cherry picker and kind of a headhunter going down to Southern California and picking up corals from a lot of the international importers. I was very familiar with corals, and as part of the reason why I was invited to take part in the coral reef management here in the Cayman Islands, because I was pretty much the only guy here that knew what all these things were and how it all goes together. When I got here, there was catastrophic damage everywhere, especially on the west side of the island. But about 5 years previous, we'd had a Category 5 hurricane, and it sat on this island for 3 days and just annihilated the reefs. And they're coming back. The water quality here is good, but we have regular incidents of bleaching all around the island. And it went from one every couple of years to pretty much we get it every single summer now. And on top of that, we have monitored a number of diseases here on island that are wiping out species of coral one by one. I look at pictures that people have taken 20, 30 years ago, back in the 70s or the 80s. That was 20 or 30 years, right? Yeah. But it's like a different world underwater. The photos that I see are staghorn corals as big around as my arm. 9 centimeters across is the size of an adult staghorn coral's branch. Most of the ones that we see right now are probably less than 5 years old. They're lucky to be 1 inch across. And that's being generous. At the thickest part, at the most hardy part of their base, most of the branches are 1 to 2 centimeters across.
Wow.
They're babies.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's something that, I mean, especially in the Caribbean, it seems like, you know, out of the two of those kind of large branching type corals, like we would kind of call them, they create that kind of structural diversity within the coral reefs in the Caribbean. And that's kind of the way I understand it, is what makes them so important, is that they provide habitat by kind of making this, dimensional, three-dimensional type shape within the water column where fish can hide and things can grow. So without those species like the staghorn and elkhorn corals to be there and create habitat and be there to, you know, absorb storm energy and things like that, I mean, you must be seeing all kinds of impacts of losing just those two species, or at least seeing a decline in those two species alone, right?
Absolutely. And you hear fishermen talk about it. You hear long-term dive industry professionals talk about it. There's not as many fish as there used to be. And the fishermen blame the divers. The divers blame the fishermen. The sad reality is the fish don't have anywhere to live right now. I like to visualize it like a parking lot for a Walmart. Imagine it was all fenced in and you let a bunch of baby chickens loose in that giant Walmart parking lot. Then you let 3 big hungry dogs loose in that parking lot. There wouldn't be very many chickens when they got done. But if you parked a car in every parking spot, let those same chickens and those same dogs loose, yeah, the dogs are going to eat some of them. That's part of the circle of life. But a lot of those chickens are going to grow up. They're going to have little baby chickens of their own. But if you slowly start moving those cars out, there's not going to be anything left. Those dogs are just going to eat all the chickens. And that's the problem that we face right now. I think a lot of people misunderstand the level of threat that the corals are under right now. We are at the tail end of an extinction event. It already happened. We don't have to make peace with it. We just have to recognize that it has already occurred. And when I say we're at the tail end of an extinction event, right now, in the Caribbean region, 96% of all stony coral has died.
Wow, yeah.
That's a staggering number.
It's already basically done at this point. And we didn't stop it. We didn't react. We didn't know what to do. But there's still 4%. We can't save the greater region as a whole until we address the reasons why that 96% has died. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but I watch television and I'm not altogether sure that the powers that be around the world are quite on board with saving the coral reef. But yeah, that doesn't mean that's going to remain this way forever. I think sooner or later, changes have to occur. And if it's 50 years or 100 years down the road, we have to plan for a program that will allow that remaining 4% to survive in a protected environment. And we have to plan real carefully to come up with what those protected environments are going to be, mm-hmm, and where we can strategically choose to place those, how we can make it so that those locations can seed other islands, that can seed the islands that they're at. And honestly, after I'm long gone and dead, probably survive on their own, because I doubt I'll make it another 100 years. I'm close to halfway there already. And unless they come up with some sort of long life treatment, I won't get to see that end product. But I think we have a project put together that allows for that long-term goal. And again, It it's a bit fatalistic. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it all died. Mm-hmm. However, there are some places, and by pure luck, honestly, the Cayman Islands fit this to a T. Like, I couldn't have drafted up a better wish list of environmental situations. You think, what would a coral need to survive in the wild? Given a little bit of a head start, it's going to need light. We get plenty of that. It's going to need good water quality. We've got that. In fact, this island is a little pinnacle of coral that sticks up 1,000 feet from deep water. And it's surrounded by some of the deepest water anywhere in the world. In fact, 20 miles to the east of us, southeast, is the Cayman Trench. It's the third deepest part of the ocean anywhere on the planet. We have an incredible volume of water that can help mix with this little bit here at our shore area to keep that water quality up. It needs to be in a place that has also got some degree of marine park laws and some degree of law and some reliability in that law. This is a British Commonwealth territory. I know they're going through some issues right now with the UK, but at the end of the day, they've been around for a really long time and there's some stability there. They've got marine parks on this island that have been around for decades. And even the island itself has been a central part of the entire story of scuba diving since the days of Jacques Cousteau. Ask anybody who's into scuba diving, if they're over the age of 40 or 50 years old, they've probably been here or at least know some of their friends who have been here. It's been a central place. So we've got a lot of positive things going for us. On top of that, we have the one really critical element that I need for our program to keep these corals alive past that 100-year mark, even after we're no longer able to care for them, as long as we give them a little push. We've got deep water. The edge of the island goes from 70 foot deep to 1,000 foot deep, pretty much vertical all the way around the entire island. My overarching plan is not to raise corals in a nursery. It's to take those corals and evenly distribute them 1,000 meters, roughly 1 kilometer, around the entire island for about 5 years. During that time, the population of staghorn that's in the shallow reefs, so between 30 and 70 foot, should blossom. What we're observing right now and what we're anticipating is essentially a 100-fold increase in population as a start off, potentially higher within the 3 to 5 years that the nursery trees will be functioning. The real trick with that is I need those corals then to continue spawning during the course of the next 20 years and to create a substantial volume of coral on the top of that mini wall at 70 foot, down to as deep as 150 foot.
So the idea then is kind of to, like, the different than kind of, I guess, what I've, you know, learned about in the past is, like, what you're trying to do is you're using the deep waters surrounding the Cayman Islands and the currents that naturally, you know, surround the island to use that as a way to naturally send baby corals, per se, around the island and kind of repopulate those lower depths where you know that the corals are doing better. So you kind of, you're setting up these areas, you know, in areas where you think the corals are going to grow, and then you're going to just let them kind of take things off from there. Is that the idea?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And
do what it wants to do.
Yeah. And we already are observing corals in the 100 to 120 foot range at both the Sunset House and Dive Tech Nursery cone of dispersion from the nursery structures. What we're hoping we can get is enough down deep that we, 100 years down the road, have viable populations that can then reseed the shallow reefs around the island, because I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but remember that 96% death rate of corals? 20 years ago, corals in 20 foot of water tended to survive pretty well. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, they were having real problems with it. They couldn't quite figure out why they weren't surviving. Right now, corals don't survive in 20 foot of water. They don't survive in 30 foot any longer. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I can't imagine that that trend is going to just fizzle out and stop. I fully expect by 2050 or 2070, you know, a good 50 years down the road, that the corals that are currently on our mini wall between 30 and 60 foot deep pretty much all be dead. And that's why it's so important that we get those corals to breed as much as they can in the meantime, to get those corals off the edge of the wall down 100 to 150 foot, because those corals should still be safe. There's cooler water down there. There's more light refracted and prevents them from bleaching and being quite so beholden. There's a whole different ecology down there. They don't have the same predators. Now, the predators may follow them down there, but believe it or not, there is historic precedent for this. It goes back a little bit further than most of us would like to remember, but within 10 to 20,000 years, we have encountered and recovered from a very substantial ice age. During the height of that ice age 20,000 years ago, the waters around the world were soaked up in the ice sheets, and that brought the sea level down just about 300 foot. When it did that, the corals that are currently living here in 30 foot, or that were living here a couple decades ago, and even 5 foot of water, they lived in 5 foot deep water off the edge of the island. They moved down as the water level lowered. The corals that drifted up onto the hard pan died. And the ones that were pushed into 50, 60 foot, 100 foot survived. And over the course of 1,000 years, they migrated themselves down the edge of the island. And by the time that 20,000 years hit, they were way down the edge of the island. As you go down about 400 to 600 foot, there's an area called the sponge belt that's not been exposed to air in close to 500,000 years. And it's an area of massive sponges, but no corals, because corals haven't grown down there in forever. But there are the skeletons of those long dead corals from 20,000 years ago. 10,000 years ago, the waters were about 50 foot shallower than they are right now. And as that water slowly melted back into the sea, as the ice caps dissolved, the water level rose. And as the corals down there, 300 foot down the wall, spawned, they slowly staggered themselves back up. I kind of visualize the effective depth of coral recruitment as the new surface of the water. And right now, based off of our studies, it's at about 30 foot. We have a 0% survival of any corals in that cone of dispersion in any water shallower than about 27, 28 foot.
Right. So in layman's terms, what does that mean? What do you mean by your cone of disbursement at 30 feet? What does the recruitment mean?
When a coral spawns, it doesn't have eyes, doesn't have ears, doesn't have feet, fins, nothing. It just is a little gamete, a little single cell, and it is completely at the mercy of the currents. As it begins to develop as a larva, it does develop a sense of smell. And so if it smells that it is somewhere over the reef, it will wiggle its little body and add mass to itself and become negative and negatively buoyant and sink into the water. It attracts the calcium and it attracts more organic to itself to become larger. And then when it lands, it's completely random. It had absolutely no part in determining where it lands at, left, right, forward, back, or anything. It is pure luck. And to get around that, corals make a lot of babies, like thousands and thousands of little gamete bundles, these little tiny soap bubbles. Or they release clouds of eggs and then sperm, timed very carefully based off the moon, the stars, and oh my God, so many difficult things to predict, so that they meet at the surface of the water and fertilize and then immediately sink back down to the reef.
Right. That's actually something that, I feel like I've kind of learned about over the years and kind of changed my thinking about corals, you know, especially mm-hmm. when we grow them in captivity. You know, when you think of growing stony corals in your aquarium at home, you think of it as something that's really difficult and that these species are really fragile. But the more, you know, that we dig into this, you know, I'm starting to see that, you know, no, these corals aren't fragile. These corals have lived for, you know, generations and generations and generations and are flexible and resilient to change. But the problem mm-hmm. is that things are happening too quickly, right? And so what it does seem like is that by giving them this little push, this little boost, and allowing them to kind of move, because they are these animals that get stuck in one place, that when we can mm-hmm. offer them an opportunity to be a little more mobile, it seems like it's really helping them, you know, get through this nasty period of you know, massive swings in temperature and, you know, pH yep. and things like that.
You're exactly right. Coral are incredibly robust animals. They're incredibly adaptive, but they don't operate on the same scale of time as you or I do. They operate more in the scale of geological time. And for them, I hate to say it, but the onset of a disease outbreak here in the Caribbean back in the 1980s could not have been a worse coincidental timing. Whether it was on purpose or human or whatever, it wiped out a huge volume of stony corals, and in a very short period of time. Now, under normal circumstances, corals have gone through stuff like this historically in the past, and it takes 50 to 100 years to recover, but they rebuild their populations and they live hundreds of years. It's not that big of a deal for them. They're able to overcome it. But on top of that disease outbreak that wiped out so many of the corals, we've also initiated a climate change in their environment that is so rapid and so fast moving that even if they hadn't been impacted, they would still have a very hard time keeping up with it. And in their current weakened state, they don't stand a chance. And I think at its core, that's what our program is trying to fill in, is trying to create concentrated areas of robust, healthy corals that are able to spawn to create genetic hotspots that can potentially get that migration going. I can't send divers out to 100 to 150 foot. It's just too deep. The profiles alone would be catastrophic, and the risk of injury to someone gets pretty high when you work in really deep water like that. But we can swim in, you know, 70 foot, 80 foot, and we can record what we see down deeper. We can monitor them, no problem. But I've got to get them there in the first place. And I think that moving those corals into deeper water, moving them into an area that has a greater chance of being exposed to clean water as opposed to nutrient-laden water or sedimentation or polluted water is going to be critical. And so we've done that. The entire west coast of Grand Cayman right now is currently under treatment with our program. This year, we placed 8 new sites along the 4 primary nurseries and the 3 other transplanted sites that we have that exist right now. It covers about 11 miles, a little over 11 miles. And I'm curious how this next year goes when we see our coral spawn next summer and then begin doing our surveys and I get to observe what corals survived. Because right now they're so tiny, I wouldn't be able to see them without specialized equipment anyways. Mm. But the ones that were spawned last year will be quite visible. They should be about the size of my hand and noticeable. And we've got an existing set of maps that shows us where all the corals were 4 years ago and 3 years ago and 2 years ago and 1 year ago. And as we go through each year and we remap that area and we overlay and compare the new corals that have shown up versus the existing corals that were there, and any of them that have died, any of them that are new, we're seeing a tremendous shift in the areas adjacent to our primary nurseries. And we are hoping to see the same results across the entire west coast of Grand Cayman. And we're confident enough in that result because of the repetitive nature that we saw at our testing sites over the course of several years, that not only are we moving forward with the West Side projects, but we are now also getting ready to include the southern side of the island. And there's probably about a 12-mile stretch along the southern side of the island, a little over 12 miles actually, that we're going to be going through and identifying all the coral that's, or the staghorn corals. And now we've got pillar corals and also elkhorn corals in our program. So we'll be identifying any instances of them as well. And over the course of next year, we'll get every 1,000 meters, every 1 kilometer or so, we'll put out another small nursery. And the idea is over the course of the next couple of years, we will encircle the entire island. And by the time we get done with that, the west side should be about as good as we can expect any of the areas to get. It should be easily approaching its fifth year. And my experience for the last decade swimming around on the reefs here is that while Hurricane Ivan did a lot of damage, and the corals have rebounded, some, not all of them did. The staghorn's gone. The elkhorn's gone. And there are rare instances of them still on the west side, but you could swim for 20, 30 minutes and not find one.
Right.
And that's catastrophic for a species that was the dominant species all around the island.
One thing that I definitely want to cover in this podcast is kind of breaking down on a, you know, I want to start to really explain and understand how, you know, we hear a lot about these different stressors that affect corals, and it's important to know in aquariums, it's important to know in conservation, you know, things like how sedimentation affects coral, how pH changes, how temperature changes, how, you know, changing temperatures, things like that, how each one of those as individual stressors impact corals. But for you out in the Cayman Islands, it seems like, I mean, we know the big one that gets thrown around is climate change. But for someone who's, in the water all the time, and you've lived there and you're hands-on with these corals, and you've really got to, you know, have a deep understanding on what is affecting these corals, what would you say is kind of the main culprits, you know, whether it be climate change, but then kind of to go a little deeper saying, you know, is it the effects of temperature, or what things have you noticed that you think are the biggest causes for stress on Grand Cayman corals?
Well, you'll probably laugh, but our biggest problem are those stupid damselfish.
I knew you were going to say that.
They tear everything up. And the worst part is they're supposed to be here. They are, and they live in the branches of staghorn corals. They do.
So these are non-invasive damsel?
Yeah.
Okay.
But here's the problem. A lot of these issues are rather complex. The damselfish became a problem because we overfished the grouper species that live here. Local fishermen discovered the groupers had spawning aggregation sites, and they could go in a very easy manner, catch huge numbers of grouper. And they wiped out our grouper. Like, I see more sharks, and we don't see many sharks anyways, no. But I see more sharks than grouper. And I haven't seen a large grouper like a Goliath grouper in years. I heard there's one over at the wreck of the Kittiwake, but that was just random here. It's been years since I've seen one. And even then, I'd find maybe one or two a year, even back in like 2008 or 2009, 2010. They just are gone, and they're not coming back is a bigger problem. But the thing is they used to eat the damselfish, and the damselfish, there was a bunch of them. So the damselfish were under heavy predation. And to get around that, the damselfish over the thousands of years or whatever, them being here in the island, they made larger and larger clutches of eggs and have a, quite honest, fantastic survival rate. And so now, instead of having in that same 1,000-meter area where I'm surveying, instead of finding maybe 50 or 100, there are 50,000 or 100,000 damselfish. They are literally and behind every rock, every coral, everywhere. And it's saturation. Each one of them needs to pair up with another one of their species and then claim an area about the size of a basketball that it'll kill on a staghorn coral, which again, remember, if I've raised it up for a year, it's only the size of my hand, which is smaller than a basketball. So there's a problem, but they're looking to damage an area about the size of a basketball that they can turn into a little algae farm for them to create the source of their food, because that's what they're supposed to do. And when there were miles of the staghorn coral 3 foot deep and 20 to 50 foot across, it was no big deal. But when there's hundreds of thousands of them all around the island, and there's one coral of the staghorn species every 20 minutes or 30 minutes of swimming, they find it and rip it to shreds. And so one of the biggest challenges that we have right now isn't global warming. It's not pollution, because honestly, pollution here is a bit of a limited concern. There are some issues that we deal with, but not anything like what most larger areas are stuck having to deal with. But instead, it's these damselfish that when our corals spawn and the little baby corals turn into hand-sized corals, sooner or later, the little baby damselfish get chased out of their home area and have to go find somewhere new to live. And when they find a staghorn coral, they're like, yay, and they rip it to shreds.
So for the fish geeks out there, what do you have a common name for this damsel, or do you know what kind of species it is?
The three-spot damsels, or the bicolor damsels here in the Caribbean, they're a little white and brownish-black, kind of half and half with a yellow stomach. They are some of the worst offenders. We've got the dusky jawfish, which when they're little are actually really pretty. It's like the ones you find at the pet store from the South Pacific. They come in beautiful colors, blues and yellows. We've got one called a jewel damsel that is that glorious, bright blue flecks on it, like an iridescent blue body. It looks like a living piece of art. And when they get older, they turn into these brown, gray blobs, little fist-sized fish with big, thick lips. And they're probably the meanest things in the ocean. I tell you, if they were 6 foot long, I wouldn't get in the water. They will attack a full-size human nonstop, biting at you. And it's adorable. Have you ever been bit by your clownfish?
Mm-hmm.
They're the same species, basically. They're related to clownfish. Right. They're part of the same family of fish. And a lot of the same personality. They just are belligerent as all get out. And they specifically seek out our corals and tear them up. And it's just maddening trying to figure out how to deal with it. In fact, what we have noticed is that while the larger species of grouper got wiped out, there are some smaller species, the Graysbys, the Hinds, the Conies, that are little 3-inch to maybe a foot long, small groupers that do still live on the reef, that are territorial and that we can identify during our surveys. So we watch for those, and we are looking to observe an increase in their populations, because they're able to eat the baby damselfish. They can't eat the big ones, but they can eat the juveniles. And in fact, that's a large part of their diet. And so as they're thinning out the babies, the parents establish a territory and then chase the babies out as they become sexually mature and start fighting for territory. And what we find is there is a saturation of how many fish can fit in a square meter or a 10 meter square area of reef surface, because Each damselfish will pick out a basketball size area, and then 3 foot in all directions, he will fight anyone that comes in there. And out to 5 foot, that's kind of a no man's zone. And if there's another damselfish 8 to 10 foot away, that area in between them, those corals are safe. And we literally have to survive or expect the corals that spawn, that land on the reef, that grow to adulthood, that don't die from other environmental issues. They have to fit inside that little band of not the basketball area that the damselfish killed and not the other one that's 8 foot over that way, or it's almost like a grid pattern, but that area in between them, that no man's land for the damselfish, that's the only place where our corals can survive.
Mm-hmm. Are the fisheries management folks around the Cayman Islands working to bring back the groupers right now?
Yeah, there's a number of groups that are involved in that. I know Guy Harvey with the Guy Harvey Ocean Foundation. He's been very much leading the charge on trying to get the grouper species back. The sad reality is, out of the three islands right now, I think only Little Cayman has one spawning aggregation site that is still viable. All the rest of them, and there was like seven or eight, are just non-existent. And there are none here in Grand Cayman that are viable. And it's been 15 years of them working diligently. It is definitely an uphill fight. Mm. And I commend them for such a long and difficult task and sticking with it. But it does show how complicated and how intricately tied together this whole web of life is underwater. I think all too often people think of the sea as this homogeneous area, and it's not. If anything, it is far more geographically unique from one spot underwater compared to another spot than anything that exists on dry land.
So I have a couple more questions sort of off the track a little bit, but I've heard in more than one place, and this will be a controversial statement, that places like Florida is a lost cause, because until they deal with the runoff and the red tide and stuff, what the work that they're doing is possibly futile. Now, that all leads back to the conversation about getting buy-in from politicians. So I guess my questions are, how did you manage to get the Cayman Department of Environment, the DOE, to buy into what you're doing? Because I've noticed since I got to know you, there's been an upswing in their sort of seems to be their connection with you and their involvement with you. And then the other part to that question would be, people are probably wondering, due to COVID and things being quieter, no tourists and stuff, what have you noticed around the island, and is there changes in the wildlife?
Well, to answer the first part, I'm afraid you're very much correct. There are areas all around the world where I don't think we have the technology or the means to fix the reef right now, because the world changed way too much. They can't survive there any more than we could be dropped off naked in the Antarctic and expect to survive. The place is just dangerous, deadly to corals. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be an underwater environment, because as I said, the underwater world is far more diverse than we would ever think. A reef that was covered in coral will change to a reef that's covered in sponge and covered in gorgonians, or even algaes and slimes, but it will be repopulated with some other version of life, but it won't be the spectacular jewel that we remember from the late 1900s. And until we do address the problems that caused that in the first place, no amount of hoping against reality is going to change that. And as an example, Florida, as far as I understand, at the last time I checked, is down to just over a 1% survival of stony corals right now. They're kind of leading the charge on areas that have been stripped completely bare of any stony corals. And it is a combination of probably a dozen, if not two dozen, different factors. But first and foremost is rising water temperature, increased storm activity, and pollution. And until we can address the causes of those, kind of like the damselfish, it's not as easy as just managing the damselfish. There's other things that lead into why those storms arrived, why the water's getting warmer, what's going on with that pollution, why is it there? We have to come up with real solutions for those issues before we can attempt to restock those areas that we historically recall. I've been there. It was this way. Because whatever that place used to be, it's not anymore. And it's a terrible tragedy, but it didn't happen on accident. I wouldn't go so far as to say we did it on purpose, but we kind of did. And I hate to be flip about it, but it was awesome. We've got cell phones, the internet, and airplanes that can fly around the world, and massive tankers that can carry fuel from far off countries and supplies and items from all around the world. We live in a prosperity that is unrivaled, but it came with a price, and it wasn't a price that was explained at the beginning. And we have to look real carefully at all of those decisions and how they play into that in price. And, I don't want to get rid of the internet. I don't want to get rid of my phone or my vehicles or any of that. But maybe there's a smarter way we can use all of those things and undo what we did on accident. I mean, we still did it, but it was on accident. It's not like we're out to like, oh, stupid reefs, kick. But maybe there's a better way, a smarter way we can end up with the same results for the neat stuff without all the terrible side effects.
Yeah. You know, and I really love the way that you put that, Aaron. And I think that that's something that we're really going to try and tackle through this podcast. And, you know, we're reef keepers and, you know, we have a love for this hobby and we've grown through this hobby to have a love for the natural environment and the actual ecosystems out in the ocean. And that's been the kind of our window into the ocean. But I think that's a really great place to end this first episode off. Like you said, there's a price that we paid with all of the growth and development that we've had. And as great as it is, we have to start getting really intelligent. And we need to really start thinking about how we're going to keep these natural ecosystems that we depend on around, not just for their beauty and their own intrinsic value, but also because they play an important role in keeping our world a healthy place. So I really, really, really appreciate your time tonight, Aaron. And you're going to be basically a co-host with, I don't know if Ian told you this. I don't know if Ian broke the news to you, but we would love to have you on here, you know, every now and again and get updates on what's going on with you. We look up to you for all of the great things that you're doing out there in the Cayman Islands. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's amazing where an hour flew by. I have so many more questions, but we could go on forever. So I guess we're going to cut it off somewhere.
Yeah.
We'll stockpile these questions and we'll...
I'll write them down.
For sure.
We definitely... A big part of what Mitch and I are trying to do here is raise awareness for the eco-divers because we've become involved with it. I've been there personally. You can go there and be part of it. It's accessible to anyone, which is what I love about it. It's run by volunteers. So what we're trying to do here is raise awareness, obviously raise funds. We had a lot of things in the works this year with coral shows and things.
Oh man, yeah.
That all went south and is just ruined a lot of hard work, but we hope it'll come back again next year. Aaron's got his nonprofit status now. We're going to get that going here in Canada as well. There are a lot of things in the works, so we want to engage as many people as possible to the great work that's being done down there, and you know, they need our help.
Well, I would also like to say I really appreciate the help that you all have already been. Ian has been a fantastic asset and friend and kind of cheerleader and organizer and so many things that it's honestly, it's a bit overwhelming, man. I really have to express my sincere appreciation. And it's just, I am so happy that people even care about what I have to say, because this is, it's almost over. It's almost too late. And I really think we can save this. I really, really do. Or I just wouldn't waste my time. But it's not going to happen the way that people have been doing things. It didn't work 20 years ago. It didn't work 10 years ago. And it's not going to work 10 years from now. We've got to come up with a new plan. And I think I've got one that is effective. I think I've got a long-term prospect with it that makes this bypass the extinction that is absolutely almost over with. And fact that y'all even allow me the ability to kind of rant on like I do, is very much appreciated. I cannot express that enough.
Well, you know, I tell anybody that'll listen to me that there's a moment in life sometimes where you see a situation and you meet a special group of people or person and they have an impact. And that first time I got involved and met with you guys, I could see there's something going on here. And you have
I did not come here to do this. I just thought I was going to be a dive instructor and drink beer on a tropical paradise and have cool stories to tell my friends when I went home.
Yeah.
And that was like 12 years ago now. And then even then, like coral stuff was like something I had done in the past. And it was really neat and not even a blip on the radar here. And I had heard about coral restoration projects and coral bleaching, but it was all still kind of hazy and new, and I didn't know a lot about it. And just as things went on, I got to see it up front happening in front of me. And I was like, you know, all my friends, I think I'm the only one that knows what this actually is. And it turns out I was wrong. I've got quite a few friends here on island who do understand this stuff and who are motivated to take part in it. And people like yourselves that come from all around the world to get involved, to do something. And because we had to move at such a slow pace, getting everything set up, I really got to super overanalyze everything. And if you've met me, I overanalyze so much in my own life. It's really been an asset for me. And the end result is something that works.
It's well, and I think that's different. The key. We've got to take your energy, and we need to see what people need to see what you're doing. They need to hear about it. They need to understand it better. And I think we have a platform in our hobby to do that. I've reached out to some of our manufacturers and different things, and they're really quite fascinated. And I think the more we can put this in front of them, the more we're going to get some support for this. So I'm looking forward to where we can take this.
Well, I got started in the marine ornamental trade too. That's how I learned all the stuff I know how to do. I remember back in the day making fragging videos for all the myceriums and stuff. I had these beautiful chalices, bright blue and pinks and greens from Australia. And I was like, okay, so these are like really expensive. I got these up. Am I going to cry? And so I real carefully documented everything. And when I got done, it came out great. So I posted the videos and stuff showing how to use all these Dremel tools and pliers and clippers and stuff and do it real carefully. And
I'm going to get on Google and search those up. But anyways, we better cut this off. But Aaron, thanks so much for your time. We will definitely get you back on here again now that we've got our technical glitches filled out.
Yeah.
There's so much more we can talk about.
And if anybody does have any further questions, of course, you can email us at fortheriefpodcast@gmail.com. And you can also check out more about the Cayman Eco Divers through caymanecodivers.com. Aaron, is that probably a good website to direct people to if they have?
We've got the Cayman Eco Divers .com website that is focused around what was our dive operations, but we've kind of turned that off for about the last 2 years. But it does have a lot of information about our coral program. I would also direct people to ecodiversreeffoundation.org. It's a blog site and it's terrible, but I totally have people that are telling me they can help make it not terrible. But it explains more about what we do, how we've done it, some of the things that have been involved. Or on social media, on Facebook, check out Cayman Eco Divers or Eco Divers Reef Foundation, and on Instagram as well, although I've been terrible about that and have not posted it so much. Coronavirus threw me off. It was really bad.
Basically, you can contact any of us and we will put you in touch with Aaron and tell you how you can help. And it does more than you know. So we'll please do what you can.
As well.
Yeah. So anyways, that being said, thank you again, Aaron. And
absolutely.
We'll end this podcast right here.
Awesome. Right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.